The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing and downloading and letting people know about the show. We really do appreciate it. Coming up on this week's program, we'll be talking about a new type of thruster that could change how we explore space by multiplying the speed at which we can fly by a factor of 20, bringing us potentially to the moon in 30 minutes. If you'd like to contact us on the program, you can email us at science@newstalk.com or you can find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience. First, though, we're going to take a look at the week's biggest news stories in science. And joining me via Skype are Drs. Lara Dungan and Shane Bergen from UCD. You're both very welcome, folks. Our first story. Like a is a great success for Irish research because it's a front cover of Nature Journal, which is a hugely prestigious scientific journal. And it's an Irish researcher, Professor Emma Teeling, and her team have unveiled something about the bat genome. What have they found, Lara?
Yeah, this is just fantastic. I don't know if listeners will remember, but last month, Irish researchers had another cover of Nature magazine. So I mean, two in as many months is just so exciting. And this is a fabulous study. Emma Teeling is a wonderful researcher and she works at UCD. And her and her team work along with researchers in the Max Planck Institute over in Germany. And they have for years been working on sequencing bat genomes. There's about 1,400 or more than 1,400 species of bats. So they account for more than 20% of all currently living mammal species, which I just think is fascinating. But bats are also amazing. And this research, this paper that's published, is a lot of long, hard work. And it's not that there's a specific headline that comes out of it. There's just lots of really, really good information and a lot of hard scientific work. And bats have a phenomenal immune system. They are able to fight off viruses in a far better way than humans and a lot of other mammals can. And this is one of the things that Dr. Teeling and her researchers were looking into. So what they're hoping is to try and figure out how it is that bats, if they get viruses such as coronavirus, which they do believe came from bats for between 70 and 40 years ago and has moved via another species into us now to cause COVID-19. So they want to know why it is that bats don't suffer and die as a result of these. And they think it's because their immune system doesn't overreact to the virus, which is what happens in humans. So we get a virus and we try and fight it off. And more often than not, our system reacts in too aggressive a manner and that can damage us. So what Dr. Teeling wants to find out is if looking at these genes in bats can help to stop this happening in humans. And she's also looked at phenomenal things. Let's not forget that bats are the only species of mammal that can fly. They also use echolocation, which again is just unique. That bats are really, really amazing. They also have exceptional longevity. They found a bat in Siberia, and now Dr. Teeling didn't, but they have found a bat in Siberia that is at least 41 years old because he was tagged and then 41 years later he was found again. You know, this kind of longevity in a small animal, there's a general theory in science that we have around about a billion heartbeats. Now, humans sort of defy this. It was thought we probably have closer to 3 billion, but smaller animals don't live as long. So, you know, if you have 1,000 heartbeats a minute, like for instance, a shrew, you don't last very long. And bats do have somewhere between 200 and 1,000 heartbeats per minute, but they live up to 40 years. They are just so exciting. And this research is just a culmination of years of really hard work. And it's just cracking open the bat genome to such a degree that, you know, we've never seen this, pretty much bar the quality that's seen in the human genome research. So it's just, it's amazing work from Irish researchers.
Yeah, huge congratulations to Professor Emma Teeling, who's been on this program a good few times and has spread her enthusiasm for bats far and wide. Shane, our second story, I kind of feel bad because you often get the climate change stories, but being sort of a physicist, you know, you're mostly practically quite useless. And so for this section, we just kind of give you the climate change stuff.
Yeah, I have like always the feel good stories. You know, Lara's there with the like perhaps we have COVID under control stories, and Shane comes around to tell us, yeah, even if we do get COVID under control, climate change is going to get us all in the end.
Sorry, Shane.
It's okay. You know, maybe some cool physics is going to happen soon, like a new particle or something. I can't wait. But this study is from the Proceedings of the Royal Society, and it's work that was done in 2016. Where researchers were diving off the coast of Antarctica, and unfortunately they discovered that methane was seeping from the ocean floor and was being released into the atmosphere. Now, I suppose you did mention this, the climate story. Perhaps fortunately, this is not one that they think is caused by us, maybe just something that's happening anyway. However, of course, methane is a very potent greenhouse gas. And so it being released into the atmosphere alongside human-caused climate change really makes for bad news.
Are we talking about a lot of methane?
It's a considerable amount. It's this 70-meter-long seam. But what they're saying is worrying is that whilst methane sort of comes and bubbles up from various places across the planet, there's normally microbes present in that environment that will eat up most of the methane after it bubbles from the ocean floor. And so not much of it actually makes it into the atmosphere. That's what's different here, is they don't have those microbes yet. So they guess that it's going to take another 5 to 10 years for those microbes to be a sufficient population to take care of the methane that's coming from the ocean floor. But they're also saying, well, you know, we've long postulated that there's a lot of methane under Antarctica, which would come from decaying vegetation from the thousands of years ago when Antarctica wasn't a frozen wasteland that it is today. And they're concerned as to what will happen in the atmosphere when that methane is released.
Do we have any numbers on that other than the size of the sea? Because 70 meters doesn't seem like an area large enough for us to worry about. Are they worried that this is sort of, that there may be many of these? Because, of course, methane is one of the worst in terms of amplifying the temperatures.
That's right. It's far more potent than carbon dioxide, for instance. And it is the gas that we associate with cows burping. They don't give a volume of gas that's being released in any given time. But what they're saying is that this shows there is methane under Antarctica. And they're saying when the planet does heat up, as it is predicted to do, they're worried that a lot more gas will come out. And if there aren't the microbes there to eat what's bubbling from the ocean, they're saying that's going to go into the atmosphere. And that's going to only add to the human or the bovine release methane from other parts of the planet. Of course, scientists are also concerned about the permafrost in places like Siberia. What happens when ground that has been frozen for thousands of years starts to thaw and the methane that's within that ground starts to come out too? People may have seen on television, there are parts of Siberia where you can drill holes and large belches of gas will come from below the surface of the tundra or forest there, and you can set it on fire as methane is a flammable gas.
Lara, our third story has to do with a remarkable claim from Chinese researchers that a blood test may be able to predict cancer years before symptoms.
Yeah, I mean, this is has the potential, I suppose, to be very exciting. And we've talked before on the show about another paper that came out reasonably recently where they said as well that they could use the blood to look at a potential 10 different cancers that might happen in people in the future. And this paper from China claims a similar thing. It's looking at 5 different types of cancer, so including stomach, colorectal, liver, lung and esophageal. So some extremely serious and deadly cancers.
Yeah.
And one of the most important things I think about this paper is that it adds to the weight of evidence. It's a really important thing in science that we don't get one paper finding one thing and we all get really, really excited about it. So what this is saying is they can use a blood test. Everybody knows that we want tests that can identify cancer before it's so serious that it's going to kill you. You want to be able to deal with the cancer that's there, but you don't want to terrify people. So you don't want to tell someone, oh, in 5 years' time, you're definitely going to get cancer, and then you're wrong. And that is a very, very miserable 5 years for that person. And that does, you know, almost as much damage. So this test has looked at blood samples, and they looked at over 600 people. And 414 of them after 4 years had remained cancer free. But coincidentally, 191 of those people did get one of the 5 cancers that I mentioned. And they looked and saw that in 95% of the participants who did get cancer, they were able to identify it. And what it's doing is not identifying cancer before it exists. They're finding very, very small amounts of cancerous cells. So they're looking at methylation, which is markings on top of the DNA. And they're finding these tiny amounts of them that are already in the system, which will and did in these people eventually grow to become a full cancer. And 95%
sort of pre-biomarkers for cancer.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, what we have to remember is that you can't detect a cancer that's not there. Now, in some cases, obviously, there are genetic reasons that you will get cancer in the future, and you can detect those before the cancer exists. But if a cancer is not there yet, you can't find it. So what these tests are looking at is tiny, almost micro cancers, you know, just a few cells that will eventually become a tumor. Mm. But it's absolutely brilliant. You know, if and when, and I firmly believe we'll be able to, if and when we can get these tests really on point, really high sensitivity and specificity, it's going to be the absolute future, I think, of testing for cancer.
I mean, knowing that it's coming before it's come must be hugely beneficial in terms of less invasive, less intrusive therapies, the end of potentially surgery, and the end potentially of even something as heavy duty as chemo, if you can identify what sort of cancer, where and when. Our final story, Shane, has to do with the sort of season that we're in. It's Mars season.
Yeah, it's rocket launch season for anyone who wants to go to Mars. So get your tickets while they last. So this is the second of three missions that are going to Mars in this window. There's every 26 months, the Earth comes to its closest point, or I suppose the distance between the Earth and Mars is at its least. And so that's the point at which you want to launch your rocket. And so recently, the United Arab Emirates launched their HOPE mission, and next week the US will launch the Perseverance mission, and they're all going to Mars. So this is the Chinese story that just launched. And the Chinese have had a bit of a mixed bag history when it comes to Martian missions. Recently in 2011, they tried to launch a mission on the back of a Russian rocket, and unfortunately it broke up in the atmosphere. So this time they're doing it themselves. And they've used, I think this is the concerning name of the rocket. It's the Long March 5 rocket, Mao's Long March, of course.
Right.
So he eventually got there, I suppose. So they're hoping that their Martian missions will get there too. And they're looking for, they say they're looking for underground water and signs of ancient life. Of course, what like all these countries are doing is just trying to make a name for themselves, US included. Like whilst science gets done when we go to space, it's always political, these sorts of things. But look, we learn new things on the back of it. They've been very secretive about what's involved in this mission. However, a recent paper in Nature Astronomy reveals that this is going to have two parts to it. So they're going to have both an orbiter, so something that will stay in the atmosphere, or not the atmosphere, but will orbit Mars. And then the other part of it is going to be a lander. So that's quite significant, because the United States is the only country that has successfully landed anything on Mars. So it is very difficult to land anything on Mars. And people have crashed things into the surfaces many times. The first landing on Mars was back in the 1970s, when the Viking mission famously sent back images of the red planet. And since then, as I said, it's only been the United States that have done so. They have the Curiosity rover there at the moment.
Why is China so secretive? Do we know why? You know, the Americans are always, this is what we're doing, this is how we're doing it. They put almost a Hollywood score to it, and are very open about their Mars missions. I mean, is it the history of failure that maybe China doesn't want to say we're doing this in case it doesn't work, and then if it doesn't work, they can say we meant that. That's what we wanted to happen.
So I suppose it's the nature of these societies. Like the Soviet Union was similarly caged about what it said it was going to do. The American approach to funding NASA has always been based on huge public support that it gets. Yeah. And that is reliant on it having a fantastic public relations setup, which it does. Yeah. Like, you know, we'll often give credit to NASA for European Space Agency missions because we just assume everything in space is NASA because their branding is that good.
Okay. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Lara Dungan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Johnny.
Now, News Talk Studio in Dublin City Centre is about 30 minutes from Croke Park if I were to walk there. If I was in a car and there was no traffic, I might get to about Newgrange in 30 minutes. If I owned a jumbo jet, I might even make it to Edinburgh. And in this increasingly hypothetical situation, if I had an X3, I could, in theory, get to the moon. So what is an X3 and how on earth does it work? Well, joining us now is Professor Alec Gallimore. He's Robert J. Vlasic, Dean of Engineering at the University of Michigan. You're very welcome to the program, Alec. We're always excited to hear about next step technologies, and this certainly seems like one. Your interest is in propulsion and thrusters. What is electric propulsion there, and why is it of interest?
Yeah, let me use an automobile analogy, if I will. And of course, we have two major types of vehicles, right? The one that's very popular and pervasive is, of course, the internal combustion engine. There you're taking a gasoline or diesel fuel, and you're burning it with an oxidizer, which is the oxygen in the air. And we're all very familiar with that. You go 300-400 miles, you have to fill up the gas tank and so on. What you're able to do, though, is it's very reliable. It has typically good acceleration, decent range, but well proven technology. Electric propulsion, you can almost think of it as the electric vehicle version of that in many respects. In the concept of electric propulsion, you're not burning a fuel and oxidizer. What you're doing is you're using the power that's being generated on board the spacecraft. But unlike cars, which use batteries, of course, to energize its motors, the power sources of the spacecraft are either solar arrays, convert sunlight into electricity, or eventually, in the not too distant future, hopefully nuclear reactors that actually convert thermal energy from nuclear reactions to electricity. Once you have that power that's being generated, what we do in electric propulsion is put a huge amount of energy in a small amount of gas. 100,000 times more energy per mass of gas than you can with chemical reactions. And what that does is that heats up the gas to super high temperatures. So in a chemical system, you might talk about temperatures of thousands of degrees Fahrenheit. In a plasma, you can talk about millions of degrees Fahrenheit. So when you have that energetic plasma, and a plasma is nothing more than a super hot gas, but it's so hot that its constituent properties of having a positively charged nucleus with these electrons that are of equal charge orbiting it breaks apart. So you have positively charged what were nuclei, now they're ions, and then these now free electrons. And these electrons are the same electrons that make up lightning bolts and what drive electrical current through our homes and our cars and so on and so forth. So once we have those charged particles that are separated through the high temperature plasma, a process called ionization, those particles react very well known ways to electric fields and magnetic fields. So we can apply electric fields and magnetic fields to take that plasma that we've created and shoot it directionally in one direction, not the back, at very, very high speeds. Speeds approaching 10 times or even more than what you get from a chemical system. And that's the magic. What that allows you to do is either accelerate the spacecraft over time to speeds you can never achieve with a chemical propulsion system, or to do the same sort of mission you might do with a chemical propulsion system, but use much, much less propellant, much less fuel oxidizer.
So essentially what you're saying is you're using the energy of the rocket to ionize this gas, which creates a huge amount of propulsion, and that can get you to what sort of speeds?
Right. So there's a difference between acceleration and speed. And so these systems have relatively low acceleration. It's literally the tortoise and the hare being the chemical rocket system. But eventually, over enough time, you can outstrip the chemically propelled spacecraft by a huge factor if you have enough time. So theoretically, with either a super advanced nuclear reactor or actually beaming the power from the Earth through a laser to a spacecraft that has essentially solar arrays that would capture it, we've done some studies with NASA that show that you can get a top speed over the course of quite a bit of acceleration time of around 500,000 miles an hour. And at that top speed, you cover the distance between the Earth and the Moon in 30 minutes.
500,000 miles an hour. Like Mars is a, what, 100 million?
Yep. Yep.
You're talking about 10 days to get to Mars as opposed to 7 months.
Right. And so the thing is, there's top speed and acceleration. So it's almost like the dragster can go at 200 miles an hour, but it takes 2 weeks to get up to 200 miles
right.
an hour.
And so what you're saying is for something like the moon, it wouldn't make any sense. But a distance of 100 million miles, how long might it take to get to a factor of that, 250,000 miles an hour or 100,000 miles?
Yeah, so it's interesting. What you would do is you wouldn't actually, believe it or not, use the same electric propulsion system for going to Mars as you might for the Interstellar Probe, which was the study. The study on the 500,000 mile an hour spacecraft was saying, we want to get something as fast as possible. And even if it takes us 3, 4, 5 years to accelerate it to that speed, once it's at 500,000 miles an hour, it's got a long ways to go for interstellar space.
Right.
For Mars, what you would actually want to do, believe it or not, is you would want to tone down the voltage or the exhaust velocity of the thruster. So that you have this compromise of having good performance, which means good miles per gallon, if you will, use the amount of propellant that you need in a very miserly way. But you also don't want to do it so much that the thrust is so low that it would just take forever to accelerate. So there, for example, in an interstellar probe, like the one that goes up to about 500,000 miles an hour, you might tune the engines so that the speed at which the plasma leaves the engines are leaving at something like 200 kilometers per second, super fast. By the way, for a chemical system, that's the best we can do is under 5 kilometers a second. So 200 kilometers a second is a huge difference in exhaust.
Yeah.
But for a trip to Mars, believe it or not, the optimum for a variety of reasons is more like 30, maybe 40 kilometers a second or so.
You're listening to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm speaking to Professor Alec Gallimore from the University of Michigan about his thrusters, which one day will travel up to 500,000 miles an hour. So if you're using electricity to ionize the plasma, my understanding is that this is what also happens in nuclear fusion reactors, that plasma is held with a magnetic field, and then it creates a similar reaction. You're talking about a lot of energy required, but the fuel, could that be anything? Could that be water?
In theory it can, and in practice for certain type of devices it can. In the devices that we use in space right now, and it should be made clear that these fall thrusters and gridded ion thrusters are routinely used on communication satellites, other types of Earth orbiting satellites, as well as deep space probes. So it's not just science fiction. These are actually a mainstay of spacecraft propulsion. In fact, some satellites are launched without any chemical propulsion system whatsoever.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm, yeah, so that's one thing to keep in mind. So so for those type of systems, Hall thrusters, gridded ion thrusters, which my lab has been working on for decades, we typically use an inert gas like xenon, sometimes krypton, actually. There are other types of devices that we're developing in our laboratory that uses, actually, believe it or not, high power, high energy density radio waves. And unlike other mechanisms, these radio waves are completely agnostic about what kind of propellant you use. And so that makes a lot of sense if you're thinking about an interplanetary spacefaring society, because the idea is that water appears to be somewhat ubiquitous throughout our solar system. And so instead of bringing and hauling around all the xenon and krypton that you need, which is what we do right now, you can imagine in the future that we would start off with a full tank of water, but then when we need some more propellant, we go and find some more water. And the water can be used both for chemical propulsion as well as electric propulsion, because chemical propulsion system use hydrogen and oxygen.
All right. I'm going to say to you what I said to my producer when he pitched this idea. Where's the catch? You're talking about water for fuel, speeds of up to 500,000 miles per hour, which would absolutely transform our ability to explore the universe around us. What is stopping us from using this technology? Do the levels of power that you need to create this plasma, are they off the charts? Is that just not practical to make and build into a rocket that may carry human beings at the same time? Are these thrusters not stable in some way? Why are we not doing this tomorrow?
Yeah, so to be frank, NASA is working on doing this, if you will, not tomorrow, but maybe by the 2030s or so. And it just takes a while. So to give you an idea, anytime we introduce a new thruster, we start off with what are called laboratory model thrusters, like the X3 that we developed, which is designed to demonstrate its efficacy, if you will, on the ground in these vacuum chambers. But the distance in time between demonstrating on the ground and going to a flight unit might be 7 or 8 years. So it just takes certain time to do it. But to answer your question, if you look at the Hall thrusters that we use right now, and for which we have experience with hundreds of them operating in space, they're about the size of a dinner plate. You know, they're something like 25, 30 centimeters across, and they consume 5,000 watts of power. The spacecraft that use these are large. They can weigh 5-10 tons or so. They're big spacecraft. And they typically have power levels of around 20 kilowatts or so, maybe 30 or so. Very big, right? But if you wanted to send a crew to Mars, you would need a spacecraft that weighs hundreds of tons. And instead of having 20 or 30 kilowatts of power, it would need millions of watts of power, megawatts of power. So you can imagine if you have a 5-megawatt nuclear reactor, 5 million watts, and you have a 5,000-watt thruster, you have a problem because you would need 1,000 thrusters. It's just not practical.
Right.
But what we did is we developed the X3, which is about the size of a card table, about a yard across or so. And it's around something like 50 times the power of these conventional Hall thrusters. So instead of 5 kilowatts, it's more like 200 to 250 kilowatts. And you still need a lot of thrusters, but it's much more manageable, obviously, than 1,000 thrusters that you would need for off-the-shelf type of systems. So what's limiting us, right? What's the catch? Well, one is, you know, taking the demonstration thruster like the X3 and developing it into a flight unit. But the big issue that we have is not so much the thruster or the business end, if you will. It's actually the power system. It says, how do you develop these lightweight, very efficient solar and ultimately nuclear power sources that would be needed to drive these type of missions?
So what's the goal for this? Because there seem to be a number of applications in terms of space exploration. One of them seems in part to reduce the flight time to Mars. But when you're talking about 500,000 miles per hour, I mean, that brings the far reaches of our solar system much closer and even beyond. What do you think the real life applications are of ramping up this sort of electrical propulsion to get spacecraft to travel that fast?
I would say that when you know, one of the biggest applications that we see going forward are human exploration beyond low Earth orbit. Believe it or not, the moon will have a space station, the Artemis missions with the Gateway space station, they'll have Hall thrusters as well to propel the astronauts around the moon. Ultimately, we're going to have probably nuclear-powered spacecraft sending people to Mars in the 30s, the moon to the 20s, and Mars in the 30s. Beyond that, a combination of very fast robotic systems to explore the outer edges of our solar system, in some cases having sample return missions to, say, some of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. Those would be done with nuclear electric propulsion systems. But for the super high-speed ones, like the 500,000 miles an hour type spacecraft, those are actually seen as what are called interstellar precursor missions, which is we now have two probes that are in interstellar space, Voyager 1, Voyager 2, which were launched in the 1970s. The question is, how do we get something out there even sooner and go farther than Voyager 1 and 2 to really understand interstellar space in relative proximity to our solar system? And so the notion of these interstellar precursor probes are such, because even at 500,000 miles an hour, it would take thousands of years to reach the nearest star system. So it's really studying the vicinity of our solar system.
God, that sort of puts everything right back in perspective, doesn't it? Really fantastic speaking with you, Professor Alec Gallimore from the University of Michigan. Thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, it's time to look back at some of your comments and texts and tweets from last week. Producer Aidan McKelvey joins me to dive through them. I really enjoy that piece we did last week about time and the block universe. I thought it was going to be really dense, Aidan, but actually we got a good few comments of people really enjoying it.
Yeah, it was great. I had the same worry. It's, with those topics, they're so kind of mind-blowing that sometimes you just worry that nobody's going to get it. But I find when we get comments that people are questioning their entire existence, they're usually our best pieces.
Yeah, we said in the program, you know, one of the theories is that if you have you know, with this idea of block, the block universe, i.e. that everything, time, space and matter popped into existence immediately and all at once, that's our current thinking right now, and of course our guest last week was trying to challenge that. But if that is our current understanding, it means that both the past, the middle, the present and the future have already been decided. And Sam from County Cork says, does that mean that life is predetermined, that there's no point in living? Well, Sam, I would say it gives you freedom from the choices you've made a little, and I know this sounds like it sounds like a bit of a cop-off to say you can do whatever you want, just go out and kill anybody if you feel like you're annoyed. But that's not how I'm very much a determinist. I feel like the choices I made were absolutely just the choices I had to make, and that my brain couldn't have done anything but what it does. So when I screw up an intro like I've done on Aidan so many times, I know that I have to be able to look back at that and go, no matter what, that was always going to happen. And it allows me to forgive myself for the many, many mistakes I make. And I apologize for them as if I had whale power, because I think it's a polite thing to do. But I honestly, I've found peace in that. In that, if you make an absolute balls of something, or you fail as a parent, or as an employee, or whatever it is, that you can say to yourself, that was always going to happen. And you shouldn't give yourself too hard a time. Try and learn from it and behave differently in the future.
Yeah, but the other end of that was, which you were upset before when we talked to Robert Sapolsky about free will, was that every time somebody gives you a compliment about doing a great episode of Future Proof or being a great presenter, they couldn't have done any differently. They had no option.
Yeah,
to
that's
do that.
True.
So it's just a meaningless compliment.
Yeah, all right, okay. Dara Fagan says, can't say I understood all of this, but it was brilliantly mad. That's okay. Brian Cox often gives, you know, 90-minute lectures, and he says, I don't care if everyone understands it or not, which I think is a bit, you know, having that attitude to everything you do is probably not great. Gary Phelan says, I guess there goes free will with time. Absolutely. And then Kevin, we were saying, you know, if you missed the podcast, you can get it here. And Kevin says, if the passage of time was an illusion in the first place, then we wouldn't be able to miss the show. I think you actually do need to listen to the podcast. It's not quite what we said, but thanks for your tweet, Kevin. We were also talking to Deborah Gordon about ants and their amazing abilities. Stephen Moreland says, I caught just a tiny bit of this, really enjoyable. Thanks for that, Stephen. And then Lara last week was telling us about the Andean condor, which, as I said, I may have mentioned, I got to see in flight in Argentina. And we learned that one of these condors was recorded as traveling 160 kilometers without flapping its wings once. And that is absolutely unbelievable, that 99% of the time they're not flapping. And most of the flapping happens when they're taking off. Porik was listening. He says, I just started listening to the podcast. Andean condor is taking my breath away, as I often say when I hear such gems from nature. And we think we're clever. Can't wait for the ants and other items. Well, I hope you enjoyed it, Pork, and thanks very much for your comments. And to all of yours, whether you sent them or not. If you like the program, let people know about it. We always ask you to do that. And the best ambassadors for the programs are those who listen to it over and over. So If you like it, share it with someone today. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing and streaming today. Thanks to producer Aidan McKelvey. On sound was Jojo Cardozo, and Simon Keane was researching. We'll be back with more Future Proof Extra in this podcast feed. Dare I ask you if you know what we're going to be doing, Aidan?
Yes, that will be medical physics and the sort of body scanners allowing us to see the previously unseeable with Darina Hickey.
Fantastic. Okay, we'll see you, Tuesday?
Tuesday, yes.
Tuesday, great. I should probably know that. All right, folks, thanks, Aidan. In the meantime, stay curious.